House Speaker Kevin McCarthy talks tough on Ukraine.
I do not support what your country has done you to Ukraine. I do not support your killing of the children either. And I think for one standpoint, you should pull out.
Plus, a conversation with a former ambassador about the future of Ukraine's security.
However the fighting finishes, I believe that there will be a independent, sovereign Ukrainian state on the map of Europe. And it's going to be a much larger state than the rump state I believe the Russians intended to leave behind when they launched the offensive in February of 2022.
And later in the program, we meet with a farmer who's figured out a novel way to clear his fields of landmines. Today is Tuesday, May 2nd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Monday, the White House detailed its estimates of Russian casualties during the past few months. The AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
The White House says it now estimates Russian casualties in Ukraine have sharply gone up the past several months since December.
We estimate that Russia has suffered more than 100,000 casualties, including over 20,000 killed in action.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says it's stunning.
It's three times the number of killed in action that the United States faced in the Guadalcanal campaign in World War II, and that was over the course of 5 months as well.
In November, the Pentagon estimated Russia had suffered well over 100,000 killed or wounded in the war's first 8 months. Kirby will not publicly give an estimate for Ukrainian casualties. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The Kremlin on Tuesday rejected the U.S. assessment of Russian military casualties in Ukraine as having been plucked from thin air and said that Washington has no way of obtaining the correct data. As we've just heard, the White House on Monday estimated that Russia's military had suffered 100,000 casualties in the last 5 months. Dmitry Peskov is Kremlin spokesperson.
As if they were plucked from thin air. Washington does not have the capability to give any correct figures. They do not have that kind of data. This is how it should be treated. We must refer only to the figures the Russian Ministry of Defense publishes in a timely manner.
Russia last publicly revealed its own tally of losses in the campaign in September, when Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said 5,937 Russian soldiers had been killed in the conflict. Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, says that Russia should pull out of Ukraine. During a press conference in Jerusalem, he responded forcefully to a Russian reporter's question.
I vote for aid for Ukraine. I support aid for Ukraine. I do not support what your country has done you to Ukraine. I do not support your killing of the children either. And I think for one standpoint, you should pull out. And I don't think it's right. And we will continue to support because the rest of the world sees it just as it is.
McCarthy is leading a bipartisan delegation of American lawmakers to Israel and delivered a historic speech to the Knesset, the first such address by a U.S. House Speaker in 25 years. As politicians, journalists, analysts, and just regular folks all over the world wait for Ukraine's much-anticipated counteroffensive to begin, it seems that some in Ukraine's public sphere are having a bit of fun with the idea. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv explains.
Yes, actually, it was thanks to President Zelensky, one of his latest comments, because during one of the questions when he was answering the question about the active stage of counteroffensive, he said that it will start unexpectedly. And in Ukrainian, you have a couple of words to describe unexpectedly. And one of those has this kind of linguistic form that it starts from a letter which also could be translated as from. So if you divide the word, it can sound like from unexpectedly. So from unexpectedly being a location. And this is the main joke right now, because Ukrainians started in social media and different different type of Ukrainians, just society and artists and even political personalities started to joke around it. So saying that, well, the counteroffensive will start from location unexpectedly and will probably go to some, you know, other ridiculous location. But this is, of course, yeah, this is a joke, because everyone in Ukraine is expecting this, and everyone is talking about this. But if we look from a serious side to this question, when the counteroffensive, the active phase, would start, we can definitely say that, according to Ukrainian officials, the counteroffensive is ongoing and never stopped. And this was said particularly by the spokeswoman of the South Defense Region, Ms. Humenyuk. She confirmed that particularly in the South, counteroffensive actions were on all this time. Since the liberation of the city of Kherson, it was ongoing, but basically everyone is talking about this active phase. And in terms of active phase and counteroffensive, what we also hear from different countries who are allies to Ukraine in this war, that, for example, Germany will supply additional ammunition and equipment like sometime in summer. And Ukraine is definitely trying to get as much equipment as possible and as much trained personnel as possible at one point and at one time, in order to make this active phase of counteroffensive as successful as possible.
Now, we wouldn't expect President Zelensky, anyone in the Ukrainian military, or really anyone associated with any military anywhere, to just announce to the world when an offensive would start. But we have seen an increase in Ukrainian attacks on Sevastopol. There was the train the other day in far western Russia that the tracks were blown up, the train derailed. We've seen some other Ukrainian drone attacks. Is there a feeling, a real anticipation that it has already started?
Well, these actions are definitely preparing the ground, let's put it this way, for this counteroffensive. And it might be, it might be a part of this counteroffensive. And commenting on Crimea explosions, these recent explosions that you mentioned, also the head of the spokeswoman of the South Defense Unit, Ms. Humenyuk, she confirmed that this is a part of it. And this is these actions are extremely important and needed in order to prepare the environment for this active phase of counteroffensive. And definitely inside Ukraine, there are talks about more attacks, particularly in Crimea. And again, coming back to the Crimea breach, because a lot of experts and military experts particularly believe that this should be one of the main enhance for Ukrainian counteroffensive if Russia would not have possibility to use Crimean breach. So we might see some additional attacks, and of course it's different. It's difficult at this point to say what would be the target. But the talks inside the country are very specific, that definitely Crimea is something to look at in terms of the attack and as a preparation for this of the environment and ground for this counteroffensive phase.
We'll no doubt be keeping an eye on this story. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
That was Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Now, roughly 660 kilometers south is Melitopol in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region. It's been occupied by Russian forces since March of 2022. Ivan Fedorov, the Ukrainian mayor of temporarily occupied Melitopol, visited VOA on Monday. He met with the Ukrainian service and spoke about resistance.
Partisans, it's one part of resistance that we can see now in temporarily occupied territories. Resistance started to be from 24th of February 2022, when first our thousands of our citizens go to central squares, central streets, and show their resistance. And they told many times for Russian troops, go away from our city. Of course, it's impossible to show public resistance when Russians started kidnapped our citizens, put them on a prison, make tortures and other things. And that's why resistance reborn to partisans movement. And now in Melitopol, it one of the hugest partisan resistance allow temporary occupied source of Ukraine. And now we know that it will be a great surprise for Russian troops when Ukrainian troops will come on the border of Melitopol. And of course, Russian troops will be greatly surprised when attack will be not from outside city, but inside city with support of our partisans also. And of course, we're ready, because for more than 1 year, our citizens just wait for liberation. All cities just wait for liberation. Nobody wants to live with Russian. Maybe less than 5% of crazy, but 5% of crazy, it's normal for all civil society. That's why we just wait for it, and we now make manuals for our citizens, what they need to do to prepare for liberation of our city. Now Melitopol chosen by occupied representatives as a center of administrative and logistic center of occupied territories, and 70% of logistic from Russia to Crimea now go cross Melitopol. That's why we need to close this logistic, and of course Melitopol is a gate to Ukrainian Crimea. That's why if we spoke about liberation of Crimea, it's impossible before liberation of our temporarily occupied Melitopol.
That's Ivan Fedorov, the Ukrainian mayor of temporarily occupied Melitopol. He visited VOA's Ukrainian service on Monday. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. How can the West help end the war and then help protect Ukraine after it? I speak with Stephen Pfeiffer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
Well, I mean, I think that I'd break it down into two parts. One is what we do now while the war is on. And then the second part is what happens after, you know, there is some kind of settlement to the war.
Okay, so let's talk about bringing this war to an end. How do you think we can do that the quickest?
Yeah, I think the quickest way is that the West should be providing Ukraine more arms to give them greater capability to try to break the current stalemate. And we're all waiting to see the counteroffensive, which I believe is coming very shortly, because I think it would be in the interest of Ukraine, but also in the West, and the interest of ending this war quickly, if the Ukrainians could deliver a sufficiently decisive blow on the battlefield that Moscow might recalculate what it's trying to accomplish. That'll be hard because Vladimir Putin, I think, is obsessed with Ukraine. But that seems to me the way that would actually hasten some kind of negotiation that might lead to a real end of the fighting.
So you're in the camp of providing more aid to Ukraine. Do you believe that Western or NATO troops should be sent to Ukraine?
No. First of all, Ukraine has not asked for Western or NATO troops. And second, I think to the extent that, you know, I wrote an article about, you know, Russian red lines, which I think are very, very vague. But I do go back to a Russian scholar, Alexei Arbatov, in an interview about 3 months ago, said that he thought one definite red line for the Kremlin that would provoke a very sharp reaction would be if Western forces were to enter the fighting on Ukraine's behalf. So, again, Ukraine has not asked for Western troops. What they've asked for are more weapons. So I think we've done a lot, but I think there is more that we should do and could do that would give the Ukrainians the capability to change the battlefield situation in the near term. Because I don't think a long-term war is in the West's interest. First of all, it just means more tragedy for Ukraine. But second, I think it may become more challenging in the future to sustain Western support for the kinds of contributions being made to Ukraine.
You say there is more we can be doing. Do you have an example?
I would have moved more quickly, for example, even though I think logistically it would be a challenge for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians say they can handle it. I would be providing them a faster version of the M1 Abrams tank. I think that the Europeans could have provided more Leopard tanks to give them more armored capability to punch the Russian lines. And then there's a missile system called ATACMS. It is it's a 200-mile surface-to-surface missile that the Ukrainians have said publicly that they would not use Western-provided weapons to strike targets in Russia proper. But ATACMS would allow them to target any Russian forces in occupied Ukraine, including Crimea.
When we started our conversation, you said there were sort of two things. One is bringing the war to an end, and one is security guarantees after the war stops. So let's turn now to after the fighting is finished. How do we protect Ukraine's security going forward?
Yeah. However the fighting finishes, I believe that there will be a independent sovereign Ukrainian state on the map of Europe. And it's going to be a much larger state than the rump state I believe the Russians intended to leave behind when they launched the offensive in February of 2022. But I think that Ukraine is still going to face a hostile neighbor. If Vladimir Putin is still in office, he will be somebody who I believe will be looking to rest, recuperate, and then perhaps make another offensive at some point in the future. So I think that has to be kind of the baseline planning point. The question then becomes, what guarantees Ukrainian security in those circumstances? One thing that I think Ukraine has expressed an interest in, understandably, is NATO membership. And in many ways, I would argue Ukraine probably qualifies for membership in NATO, including it's shown it has an ability not to be just a consumer of security, but a provider of security. It has one of the best military forces now in Europe. Having said that, if you check all the boxes, I mean, it's not automatic to say I've checked all my boxes, give you my membership card. NATO membership is a political decision. And basically, the other members of NATO, I believe in Ukraine's case, have to be prepared to go to war against Russia for Ukraine if they're going to bring Ukraine into NATO. And at this point, I think about maybe 10 NATO member states, mainly in Central and Eastern Europe, but I believe Canada, have indicated that they are prepared to support Ukraine's membership in the near term. The other 20 NATO members have either been silent or talk about it as much more a long-term prospect. And so I think in those circumstances, it may not be wise of Ukraine to expect NATO membership in the near term. So what is their security ticket? And I think in that case, what NATO should, or Ukraine should instead be looking for is provision of weapons. And we're talking here about Abrams tanks, Leopards, modern fighter aircraft, so that Ukraine has the ability in its own military to deter and defeat another Russian attack. I think that puts it in the Ukrainian hands. And my guess is that a number of Western countries, it would be much easier for them to provide that capability or politically than to say, yes, we're prepared to say, you're now going to get a membership invitation into NATO.
What's the U.S. position on Ukraine joining NATO?
The U.S. position, when it's asked, it seems to be that this is a longer-term prospect. Not opposed, but not saying that the United States supports immediate Ukrainian entry into NATO. And I suspect, again, this gets back to this question. At the end of the day, is the United States prepared to go to war with Russia against Ukraine? I mean, thus far, you saw this, for example, in the opposition, I think in most Western capitals, to a no-fly zone over Ukraine last year. I mean, a no-fly zone, if you were serious about it, would mean not only having NATO aircraft prepared to shoot down Russian aircraft, but to protect the planes conducting the no-fly zone, you would have to be prepared to strike Russian surface-to-air missile batteries in places like Ukraine, Belarus, and perhaps even Russia. And that's been a line thus far that Western leaders have not been prepared to cross. And I actually even wonder, I mean, you know, given that Ukraine's accession to NATO, U.S. approval would require a two-thirds vote in the U.S. Senate. I think that's possible, but I'm not totally confident that it's possible, given some of the lines of argument you've seen, for example, in the MAGA wing of the Republican Party now. So at least in the near term, I think NATO or Ukraine's security would be best secured by Ukraine having the capability, and it would mean a fairly large armaments program for Ukraine, but one that the Russians would say, look, we could not do it in 2022. You know, at some future date, we can't do it just because the Ukrainians have a much stronger military now. And then you keep Ukraine working so that it is ready for membership when the political window opens.
So that's Ukraine's security. How do we rebuild, or how does Ukraine rebuild its cities, its infrastructure, the buildings, the schools, the cities?
Well, there's $300 billion sitting in the Western financial institutions that belong to the Russian government. You know, it was the Russian government that is responsible for the destruction of Ukrainian cities and infrastructure and residences and industry. And I think the West should move to seize that money and put it into a reconstruction fund for Ukraine. And I think at some point that probably happens, because it's very difficult for me to see at some point down the road when we're talking about serious reconstruction of Ukraine, and that presumably is once the fighting has stopped. How do Western politicians go to their taxpayers and say, we need tens of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's reconstruction while at the same time handing Russia back $300 billion? That seems to me, I would not want to be the person in the U.S. government or another Western government making that argument.
Stephen Pfeiffer is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for your time this morning. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you.
A Ukrainian farmer has come up with a novel idea to remove landmines from his fields. He's outfitted his tractor with protective panels and operates it with a remote control. Reuters' Edward Baran reports.
Alexander Krivstov, the general manager at his agricultural company, has kitted out his tractor with protective panels stripped from Russian tanks and operates it by remote control. He came up with the idea after deciding he couldn't wait for overworked official D-miners to clear his field in the village of Hrakove.
We started doing this just because the crop sowing time has come and we can't do anything because the rescue services are very busy. We ran over an anti-tank mine. The protection got blown out. The tractor is safe. The mechanics were not here. Everyone is alive and safe. The equipment was restored and repaired.
After Russian forces were driven back from parts of eastern Ukraine by a Ukrainian counteroffensive last year, many fields were left covered in mines, making it perilous for farmers to sow grain for the next harvest. Using the armor from damaged Russian military vehicles to protect the body of his tractor, Krivstov bought a system that would enable one of his team to operate the tractor remotely from the bucket of a digger suspended in the air nearby. Serhii Dudak, head of the demining unit who oversees the work of the tractor, said it's useful because it can clear large areas with no risk to life.
The amount of work is huge, and we have no time to demine the fields. It would take years to demine this particular field by hand, and to guarantee that there are no mines here.
The Ukrainian government said on Friday about 30% of Ukrainian territory was mined by Russians, and that the government was focused on demining agricultural land as soon as possible.
That's Reuters' Edward Baran reporting. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.